over the phone from Groningen to Utrecht on 1 September 78.
What was your contact with this group? I mean, you were at Utrecht at that time, and they were at Leiden. So how did you find out about this?
There are two things. When Hank van der Hulst made his announced this line, that this line would be possible in 1944.
Right.
He was a student at Utrecht.
That's correct.
And
yes.
I was a student at Utrecht.
I see.
A few years younger than he. And so he returned one time from Leiden. It was in the wartime. And I was in refuge, hidden at the observatory, because otherwise I had to work in Germany.
I see.
As a student. And he was an assistant at the university, but students had to go to the university. So I was living at the observatory. And then he came back, he said, well, I've been talking to Oort has been talking to me, and Oort said it would be so nice when a line could have. Would be a line in the radio spectrum.
I see.
And so he contacted Professor Rosenfeld at our theoretical physics.
Right.
And together they found out whether there could be a line. And Rosenfeld said, well, look at fine structure. Okay, and we were very closely at the birth of the discovery of this line.
I see.
Rosenfeld suggested Van Hulst to look at fine structure. Then he looked in a list of fine structure. And of course, you look at hydrogen first because that is the most abundant.
Right.
And so the possibility of that line came up. So right from the beginning, we were very closely related to that matter.
Now, let me just get it straight. Now, you were a student, and so you had to be hiding, but Van der Hulst was a...
He was also a student, but on his passport, no, not his persoonsbewijs, as we call it in Dutch.
Right, his identification card.
His identification card was mentioned assistant, because he was an assistant at the university.
I see.
And the Germans, when they looked, they had the instruction to look at people who were described as students.
I see.
So he could go.
So he was all right.
And I was student.
Right.
But it was a small difference that made a big difference in your freedom.
Right. Any case, well, I have talked to him about this whole colloquium that he gave and so forth. Were you at the colloquium?
No, of course I could have.
Yes.
No.
Did you have any contact at all with radio astronomy before the discovery of the hydrogen line?
No. Of course, apart from this kind of discussion, it was about the same time that Van der Hulst came back. He had an occasional event to Leiden, and he came back. He stayed for 1 or 2 months at Leiden, I believe.
Right.
Then he returned, and he said, well, Oort has some idea we should make a following Reber and make a big radio telescope.
Right.
Somewhere in the field, maybe outside Leiden or so, and of course that was the first idea of building a large radio telescope.
Right.
Later
right.
Then went to Kootwijk and then was the Berg and then finally Dwingelo. But I had close contact with this radio astronomy, and then the other aspect is that the radio astronomical community in Holland was particularly at the time very small.
Right.
And Professor Minnaert, who was the director of Utrecht Observatory,
right,
was also member of the Council of Radio Astronomy, the Stichting Radio Astronomy Zonder Melkweg.
Right.
And Houtgas was secretary at that time, also from Utrecht.
I see.
So we had at our coffee lengthy discussions of all these matters.
I see.
So at the time when this 21 centimeter line was discovered, then I don't know how it went, and I was sitting with Minnaert, and he said, well, if it is in the galaxy, why not in the sun?
Mm-hmm.
So I started computing, and we computed that there was that it was actually not possible to detect it. But still we asked Müller, Lex Müller, to make the observations, and he did not miss. So he did not find anything.
Well, he has an upper limit here, I think, of about 1/200th of the continuum temperature.
Exactly, yes.
And what did your predictions say that it might be?
I don't know what it was. Maybe it has to be in the paper.
It may well be in the paper. I haven't had a chance to check it yet.
Yeah. I don't know from memory. So, and that was our first contribution to radio astronomy.
But you were primarily involved in solar work.
Yeah, exactly. that was, I was at the time preparing my thesis on the solar atmosphere.
Right.
So,
well, now tell me, as a solar astronomer, what were the primary contributions that radio astronomy was making to solar astronomy in the early 50s, yes?
I think the first contributions were measuring the continuous radiation, yes. Several people measured the radiation of the sun at different wavelengths.
Right.
So the first thing one got was a curve describing the brightness temperature as a function of wavelength.
Right.
And then several people tried to establish a model of the whole transition region chromosphere to corona on the basis of these kinds of data. I think Martin Ryle was one of the first to do that.
That's right.
And in my thesis in 52, I also produced another model.
The SMERT had one also, did you not?
Yes, several people had.
And Waldmeier, I think.
Oh, I guess so, yes, because it was very popular in these days.
Right.
And several models, there was ambiguity in the material. Several models were possible.
What was the main cause of the ambiguity?
Well, the fact that we had only integrated radiation.
Ah, yes.
At the moment that you have central limit variation, then ambiguity disappears. And then, but then it became so difficult really to derive a model from the radio observations that several people tried, but most of them failed.
Yes, right. Well, tell me, there was a controversy over limb brightening during those years.
Yes.
There were some observations that gave enough resolution, for instance, either an eclipse or a interferometer.
Right.
Were you involved in that at all?
No. I was interested, but we were not involved in any measurements of that time.
But were you involved at all in the interpretation of these?
Surely. Oh, yes. Yeah.
What was your opinion at that time about whether the limb brightening existed?
I thought that limb brightening should exist because you could predict it on the basis of any reasonable model. There should be limb brightening.
But you did not have any opinion as to which data were better. I mean, some people had data that indicated no limb brightening, and other people had some that indicated.
Yes, I had the feeling that there should be limb brightening.
Right.
This was proved correct later with detailed observations.
Right.
There were several people tried at these days to deduce the central limb variation by means of eclipse observations.
Right.
But that was not also too ambiguous, I believe.
Yeah, there were.
If you have three radio telescopes and try. Not sufficiently.
Especially if you have active regions, also.
Also, yes, surely.
Well, now, that gets us into the active sun.
Yeah.
I find a paper here in 1956
yes.
in which you discuss 1.5-meter
yes.
solar bursts. When did you get involved in solar bursts?
The history of this was in that time, Charles Seeger was in Leiden.
Right.
He came from the States, and he brought with him a number of recordings with, for that time, very high time resolution.
Right.
Something of, a fraction of a second. What was it exactly? Well, it was sure.
It was
considerably less than a second.
Right.
I
can check the papers. Yeah.
And but then, arriving in Leiden, he, of course, got involved in building up the Zwinglo equipment and in doing, not so much in observations. And he was also not a solar physicist himself. So at one time, he showed them to Professor Minard.
I see.
And then he asked me whether I would be willing to work at these things, these recordings.
Right.
And this I did together with Frans van Veer, who was then a student.
Right.
In Utrecht. So it was part of his research for his doctoral examination,
uh-huh.
for student work.
Right.
And the good thing was we had at least part of the observations were made at two neighboring wavelengths, two neighboring frequencies,
very.
I think 200 and 205.
I see.
That was good because then you could see the differences between peaks. Some of the peaks had a wavelength drift,
Right.
As well. We could infer from observations, others were bright, were strong at one frequency, at less at another frequency. And in the meantime, of course, Paul Wild and his people had already started their dynamic spectra.
Right.
Of all kinds of birds, so we knew that there were patterns that could drift over the spectrum and so on. But here we had observations at very high time resolution.
These were higher time resolution than Wild's?
Yes.
So.
Oh, yes. Purely.
So that was the advantage that you had.
Exactly. And we had exact intensity profiles. So in principle, we had the hope that, I grew up as a spectroscopist, optical spectroscopist.
I see.
So here we had again spectra with nice profiles and so.
Right.
And I tried to interpret these, particularly the type 3 bursts, like we did with radio with the optical spectra.
Of flares, you mean?
No, the optical spectra of just the spectra of the quiet sun.
I see. Okay.
How is the line broadened? Is it Doppler effect? Are there damping phenomena
right.
playing a role, you know?
What layers is it coming from?
Exactly. Yeah. It was interesting to try to translate notions from optical spectroscopy to radio spectroscopy.
Right.
So that was the main part of this work. And furthermore, we did some statistics about the grouping together of these things. But the important thing of this was that we realized that it might be very useful to do similar things as Paul Wild, but with higher time resolution.
I see.
And so this was the impulse to build, and that we dealt in Utrecht, and that was actually the first contribution of Utrecht to Dutch radio astronomy, to build an 8-channel recorder. It was a sort of 8-pin recorder.
Right.
To get the time variation and wavelength drift and so frequency drift of solar bursts in the short meter wave.
And these were at adjacent frequencies, these channels?
Adjacent frequencies, yes. Frequencies about 2 megacycle apart.
And what frequency was the main...
It was, in any case, it resulted in the thesis of Tom de Groot, T. de Groot.
Ah, yes. And what year would this be about when this was built?
The thesis was around 64 or 65 or thereabouts.
Right. So
but the work was much earlier.
Right. The equipment was built about when, would you say?
The equipment was built, let's say, 56, 57. 50, rather 57.
57.
Yeah,
so
57,
just
58 and so.
So once you had worked on this Cornell data, more or less, then you decided you were going to build something yourself.
Then instead of 2 channels, we decided we needed some 8 channels.
Right.
And this was built and operated mainly at Nederhorstenberg, at NERA.
And where is that located?
That is located close to Hilversum.
Oh, yes.
It was a PTT radio observing station.
But it's not the same as Kootwijk, it's another station.
It's not the same as Kootwijk, yeah. No. As you know, we had close relations with the Dutch PTT at that time.
Right.
And particularly the director of the radio of the section for ionosphere and radio astronomy.
Right.
Being Mr. De Voogd.
Right.
Very interested and very helpful. He was extremely keen to develop radio astronomy at his station. Now his workshop was there in Kootwijk, but his main observing place was Nederhorstenberg.
Oh, I
which
see.
Which is a small place close to Hilversum, some 20, 30 kilometers north of Utrecht.
Oh, I see.
In a rather isolated in that marshy area.
Well, in fact, next week I'm going to talk to Fokker, so
yes.
I should hear about that side of the story then.
And so at that time, and that was also again around 1960 or so, we started closer cooperation. We, Utrecht, started the closer cooperation with the NERA people and operating their radio astronomical equipment.
Right. Now let me go back though to the interpretation of the of the solar bursts.
Yes.
What were the main results that came from this work in terms of what's going on in the sun?
Yes. Well, the main result was that we had the impression that it became clear that universe were plasma oscillation.
Mm-hmm.
There should be plasma oscillation. So, but on the other hand, this were depth in a time scale of about 1 second.
I see.
And so we applied the expressions for the damping or the relaxation of oscillation as yielded by plasma physics.
Yes.
These bursts.
And did that made a coherent picture then?
That made a more or less coherent picture, although the difficulty at that time was if you have oscillations at plasma frequencies, you have at the same time a very strong absorption in the solar plasma.
Right.
And that we had to overcome, which we did not do well enough,
uh-huh.
I have to admit. We realized it, but we found it pretty difficult to treat the absorption in the solar plasma, which changes also very strongly with frequency, close to the plasma frequency.
I see.
So that was a weakness of the work, but I think the positive part was the clear insight that the oscillations were plasma oscillation, so related to the electron density, and also that there was an independent way, the damping constant, depends on temperature and density, so you got the temperature.
I see.
And then we found temperatures of the order of 1 million degrees, or 1 or 2 million degrees. Oh, a bit higher actually, a few million degrees. So, and this was, it seemed a bit high at that time, but later we realized that the active regions have higher temperatures than the overall corona,
mm-hmm.
for which we assume a temperature of 1 million degrees.
Now, by active regions, is this the same as the coronal condensations?
Yes, exactly,
right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And these type 3 bursts, perhaps, mostly originate in active regions in the coronal condensation, where the density and the temperature is higher than in the overall corona. So, the picture was not too bad.
Now, I have heard it said that the thing that really established that it probably was plasma oscillations in these bursts was the harmonics that Wild.
Exactly.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, sure, yes.
Right.
That was a very convincing argument.
Uh-huh.
The fact that there were harmonics.
Right.
Yeah.
And
this
so.
This was already known at that time.
Right, and so your work was following that, more or less.
Yes, it confirmed that there should be plasma oscillations, and then in addition, the damping yields the temperature.
Right. Now, at the Paris Symposium in 1958, you mentioned the possibility of seeing a 3-centimeter neutral hydrogen line.
Yes.
Yeah. Could you tell me, did anybody ever carry out that experiment? Or
I don't know of it. I don't. Very much later, Pierre Kaufmann from Brazil, São Paulo, Brazil,
right.
Asked me whether anyone has been observing that. I said, no, I don't know. And then at one time I decided to start again calculations to see whether there's any possibility, but I did not do so.
Yeah, I think I have vaguely I remember somebody trying this in the 60s, but I'm afraid I can't tell you who. But you were at that meeting, I guess, then.
Yes, you were, yes. Yeah.
That seems to me to be a rather important meeting for the history of radio astronomy.
I believe so.
And could you tell me any impressions that you have from it?
It was a large meeting. And all the radio astronomers of the world were about there.
Right.
I mean, it was a very, very interesting, very lively meeting with very nice discussions. It was very nice to see all the people who had done this interesting work.
Right. Do you have any particularly strong memories about particular papers or people? Maybe not necessarily in solar work, but in anything?
Yes. Well, what was interesting was, for instance, the 21-centimeter result produced by the Leiden group, by the Kootwijk and Dwingelow group.
Right.
The first coherent pictures of the galaxy came out at that time.
Right.
And that was very nice.
Was it an important meeting for solar radio astronomy, would you say, in terms of getting people together? Or?
Also, yes. Yes. For me, it was quite interesting. All the solar people were there at the same time. All the solar radio zones. So I had in my feeling, it was a very important meeting.
Right. And I suppose you met people that you had never met before, like Paul Wild and and,
yes, exactly.
And other people,
yes,
like this.
Yeah, yeah.
That about takes me up till 1960, which is sort of my cutoff. I noticed that in 1960 you began talking about solar X-rays also.
Right. Yes.
And it seems like that you are oriented towards the sun, and no matter what wavelength region is of importance, then you will consider it.
Yes.
Was this true of most solar astronomers in the 50s, that they were willing to accept the radio data as much as they would accept the more traditional kind of optical data, would you say?
Not at all, I would think. It's a curious thing that at one time solar radio astronomy was a bit strange to the classical solar radio astronomers. To the classical solar astronomers.
Right,
Yeah, they had to accept that other wavelengths could also produce information.
Right.
It took some time. Similar way we had later when space research started and when the X-ray data came.
Right, right.
It took some time for the people.
Now, can you put some rough dates on when this began to happen, that the radio results were more generally accepted, or more solar astronomers at least began to take them into consideration?
Well, I think this happened in the middle of the 50s.
In the mid-50s.
And I believe that at this meeting in 58, it was generally solar radio astronomy that was generally accepted as providing very important input to physics of the outer solar layers.
Right. And before that time, some of the traditional solar astronomers, would pay attention to it, and others would not.
Yes, exactly.
Interview with De Jager from Groningen to Utrecht on 1 September 1978.